Today finds us finishing our study in the book of Genesis. We're at chapter 9, and we're going to follow it through to the Tower of Babel in chapter 11. In chapter 9, Noah has gotten off the ark, and he's facing a strange, different situation. A different world. I wonder what devastation was still apparent. When you have mudslides, volcanic activity, the torrential rains, the landscape of the earth would just be devastated. New life is coming back. The dove returned with a fresh olive leaf, and so that would be sort of exciting, much like spring here in Wisconsin, both days of it. But to look around and to see what would still remain of the chaotic events of the destruction and devastation, that too would be sort of a reminder to Noah, a reminder of many things, a reminder that God judges sin, but also a reminder that God provided for Noah and his family, provided salvation for them. Well, the first thing Noah did, we saw it at the end of chapter 8, was to offer to the Lord sacrifices. Wherever we are in our life's stages, we need to be offering to the Lord sacrifices. As we're planning a new beginning, if you're moving to a new city, if there's a new job, a new situation on the scene, the first thing to do is to stop and offer your life to the Lord. Romans 12:1, present your body as a living sacrifice. God was pleased with Noah's response. With that, we begin chapter 9, and the first verse states, "Then God blessed Noah and his sons." And then we have a command, the first command with this new beginning. Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. Now that command sounds familiar, and it should. We saw it in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. It was a command that wrapped up sort of the creation week, and the same statements were said. Now, there are two ideas here. Be fruitful and increase in number. And if you're fruitful and increasing in number, that's going to fill the earth. That's going to populate the earth and fill it up with what God and his plans wants to occur on the earth. But before we talk about those two statements, be fruitful and increase in number, please understand that as God blessed Noah, he too is continuing to bless the world to this very day. God has mercies new every morning, the scriptures say. He's given us blessing upon blessing, John writes in his gospel. And the phrasing there in John's gospel is reminiscent of the waves on a seashore. Wave after wave of blessing is the idea. How do those waves continue? Well, time after time after time. Well, that's how God is blessing the earth. He makes his rain to fall on the just and the unjust. So we are benefiting from God's blessing this earth here at Genesis 9 on through to our day. Now, be fruitful and increase in number, two commands. That's going to fill the earth. When you compare this command, this statement, to Genesis 1, verse 28, you'll find that something is lacking. There was an extra statement back in Genesis 1, 28. It said there, by God again, be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth, and subdue it. Now that last statement, subdue it, is consciously lacking here, deliberately left off. And I'm sure God would note that scholars would understand this fact. It appears that given the state of conditions now, man is not going to be able to subdue the earth. With God's perfect creation, the plan was for man to have dominion and rule and subdue the earth. Now, we're not sure exactly what all that means, but it sort of has the idea that man would be able to accomplish perfectly, wonderfully, fully what God intended for him to accomplish there in that perfect, ideal situation. When it was good, when it was very good. Now, man has some commands concerning this sort of repopulation of the earth at this time, but that statement to subdue it isn't present. And I believe because of the fallen earth and the nature of the world and man with his sinful inclinations, every inclination of his heart is sinful from childhood on, given those conditions, conditions, those truths about this present world, man is not going to subdue it. Man will try. God graciously allows man to make advances. We benefit from many technical advances, many advances in the field of medicine and so forth. But when you look at things, you know what? Man is not subduing the earth. Although there are some advances in some fields, overall, man's spiritual state is woefully going downhill. And to me, that's the picture of this fallen world. And this current world, this post-flood world, is not the world that is going to be. It's the world for now, and God has purposes and plans. It's the world into which he's going to send his Savior. The seed of woman from Genesis 3:15 through the promises in the Old Testament are going to be fulfilled with the coming of Christ. The church age is going to be a part of this world, but at some point, the Lord removes the church, and then, as we studied in the book of Revelation, the seven-year tribulation time will come. Man will think he's conquering the world. They'll be saying, peace, peace. The Antichrist will make some wonderful achievements, be highly praised, but then his sinfulness will be made evident as he sets himself up to be worshipped. And man is going to find out that he's not going to be able to subdue the world. Now, humanism says man will conquer all. We live in a very prideful time. Because of the technical advances and so forth, man really has a sense that he's so great and he's achieved so much. And look at computers and look at satellites and world communication and whatnot. And there's a real sense that man can conquer anything he puts his mind to. Well, we're going to learn from the Tower of Babel that's not going to be true. But the lack of that statement, subdue the earth, here in this first verse, lets us know that man is not going to be successful. Remember in the Gospels, Jesus said, the poor you will always have with you. Man isn't going to wipe out world hunger. Man isn't going to wipe out poverty. Lyndon Johnson didn't set up the Great Society. All of that sort of echoes what is lacking here in this command, that statement about subduing the earth. We move on to verse 2, and another interesting change has come upon the earth. The fear and dread of you, God declares to Noah and his family, the fear and dread of you will fall upon all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air, upon every creature that moves along the ground and upon all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hands. The fear of man is put into the animals. Note, the beasts of the earth have the fear of man. And we think of the wild animals off in Africa having the fear of man, yes. But it also says the birds and every creature that moves along the ground. Now, have you ever gone into your bathroom, turned on the light, and a little silverfish was there? Does that silverfish come over to your foot and start licking your big toe? No, it scurries away. It's never seen you before in its life, perhaps. It doesn't know you. You might be a kind, nice person. Yet that silverfish, creature that moves along the ground, scurries away. Fish, they don't come over when I say, here, fishy fishies. I got to deceive them and trick them with some bait and stuff. Now, the fear of man is put into the animals at this stage. I don't believe the fear of man was in the animals before this time. I believe in chapter 2, when God had the animals parade in front of Noah, there was no fear of, Adam. There was no fear of Adam in the animals. I believe in the Garden of Eden, when Adam said, here, kitty, kitty, a little saber-toothed tiger would come over, or a big saber-toothed tiger, start purring, rubbing up against his leg. When Isaiah writes of the millennial kingdom and sort of the restored earth, he speaks about a change in animal behavior. The leopard will lie down with the lamb. The lion and the ox will eat straw together. A child will play with poisonous vipers and not be harmed. There's a change there. This fear of man that goes into the animals here in Genesis 9:2 is what we now experience. It's going to be changed. I believe, again, in the Garden of Eden, there was a wonderful relationship between man and animals. Those who have pets, those who have sort of overcome the fear of man by some intensive training in certain kinds of animals that seemed more open to that, those who have those kind of pets and those kind of relationships appreciate that interplay between man and animal. I think that's going to be one of the joys restored in the millennial kingdom, and if we can conjecture, perhaps on into the eternal state. So pet lovers can sort of be excited about that. Note, though, that there's two statements made in verse 2. The first one has to do with that fear of man being in animals. But the last statement says, they are given into your hands. This brings up the idea that man has been given by God the animals for his use. Verse 3 is going to say he can eat them. He can also domesticate them and use them to pull his plows and so forth. Now, I'm so glad that given the state of conditions now on this earth, the way they are, I am so glad that God put the fear of man in animals. What if, when there were some ants in your house, they didn't scurry away when you came in, and what if they started attacking your big toe? I'm out on the bike path riding my bike, and I see a hawk over some nearby field soaring around, and I look at it and I just enjoy it. What if that hawk viewed me as live game and started to come down and take a hunk of my skull or flesh for his food? Imagine what it would be like if there wasn't fear of man in animals. Now, from time to time, an animal will get a taste of human flesh, become a man-eater, lose that fear. What if, you know, tigers would invade downtown Bombay? Some people start to encroach upon the wilderness, and they're all of a sudden surprised when there's a mountain lion in their backyard. And if there wasn't the fear of man, conditions would be terrible. So it's a most interesting statement here that God has put the fear of man in animals. And again, it's a wonderful provision. It gives us safety. And he's also given animals into our hands. Now, a Christian should be a wise steward of all that God has given him. We know the Creator. We should treat his creation with wisdom. But a Christian knows that he has rule over the animals. Some of the animal rights activists today have lost that idea. They think an animal has as much rights as a human, even more in many settings. Not only that, but pure evolutionary thinking gives status to trees and plants and even rocks. Who are you to move that boulder to build your house? Who are you to cut down that tree? It was there before you. So they lose this whole idea of man being God's crowning achievement in creation. They lose this idea that man has been blessed by God and has been given dominion, rule. The animals have been given into man's hands. Now, Proverbs speak about a wise man being kind to his animals and seeing to their safety and treating them well. So again, Christians should be the wisest stewards, but Christians should never lose the distinction that man is over the animals and plant life and the rest of this world. God has given it into our hands to use wisely. Now for dietary things, verse 3. God continues, everything that lives and moves will be food for you. He's talking there about animal life. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. Now, there's some thought that with the water canopy, the effect on the climate would be to allow for wonderful vegetation growth. Remember, God brought up springs from the ground to water. Well, those springs burst forth in the flood, and that water canopy came down for 40 days and 40 nights. Conditions are changed. The raising of plants, the nutritional value in plants, all of that might have been greatly altered by the flood. And now, to help provide for man, God is going to allow man to eat animal flesh as well as plant life. Now, there are some today who would say, we initially were vegetarians and that's the way we should be. No. We were initially naked. And there are some nudists who say that's the way we should be. No, God came and clothed Adam and Eve. Now, in the Garden of Eden, there was vegetarian diet provided. But now, in this post-flood world, God says we can eat meat. And he has graciously given it to help, I think, the nutrition in our diet. Be careful of any teaching about dietary measures having spiritual significance today in the New Testament times. The Old Testament had God making some dietary distinctions for his people and for his purposes, and he wanted to keep his Israelites distinct from other nations and groups, and there are a lot of Old Testament commandments given to the Israelites, and God had his reasons and purposes. In the New Testament days in which we live, there are no dietary spiritual restrictions. Now, somebody might decide not to eat too much red meat, or because of high blood pressure or cholesterol levels, they might make some decisions about what they eat, when and how, and what to what degree. But don't let anybody come teaching you that, say, for example, pork is defiling and we shouldn't eat it to this very day. The New Testament says repeatedly that by this, Jesus declared all foods clean. Peter had a problem with this in his vision with the blanket being let down. There were all sorts of animals in there, and I don't doubt that there were pigs in there. And God said, take and eat. And Peter said, no, I've never eaten detestable things. And God right then says, don't call detestable what I have now made clean. Not only that, but in a couple epistles, there's warnings about false teachers. And one of the points that characterizes them is that they'll come forbidding people to eat. And then sometimes it says also forbidding them to marry. They'll come with these dietary restrictions. And it's a sign of a false teacher. It's a sign perhaps of a cult, of somebody taking control of your life, falsely presenting God's word. So be careful. God gives us everything at this stage. For a period after that, he had dietary restrictions on his people, the Israelites, during the Old Testament times. In Christ, in the New Testament times, all food has been declared clean for us. Be wise stewards of your body. Watch what you eat and how much of it and so forth. But don't attach spiritual significance to any particular form of diet. Now, talking about meat eating, the Lord goes on to speak about blood, lifeblood, verses 4 to 6 of Genesis 9. I now give you everything, verse 3 says, including the animals to eat. Verse 4 starts out with, but you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. God wanted them to drain the blood from an animal that they killed to eat. Drain the blood first before they eat it. Verses 5 and 6 go on to make a point about lifeblood, and that explains why this distinction, this command is given by God. As for your lifeblood, verse 5 says, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal. And from each man, too, I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made man. Given the destruction of the flood, one might conclude that God thinks human life is cheap. They sin, well, kill them, wipe them off. Having seen what God did in the flood, man might have a tendency to have that same response. Anybody's offending me or whatever, I'll just kill them, you know, wipe them out. God says, no, man cannot take man's life. Even if an animal takes a man's life, that animal has to give an accounting to God, has to be dealt with. We're going to see, as Moses continues to write the first five books of the Bible, he's going to give various commands from God concerning an animal. A bull out in the field that gores a human, that kills a human. An accounting must be given. This lifeblood is to let us know that God values life. Now, the book of Leviticus says in chapter 17, verse 11, the life is in the blood. And so God gives man the right to eat flesh, eat meat from animals, but he reserves the lifeblood. You cannot have that, pour that out on the ground. And it's sort of a picture of an animal being sacrificed, giving his life to provide for man. And again, all these Old Testament pictures are to point to Christ ultimately. And so this draining of the blood was a point that God wanted established. Having spoken about life, he then moves into capital punishment. If an animal kills a man, that animal is to be destroyed. Again, some animal activists today have a problem with that. And I'm thinking especially here of some dogs that are, you know, attack humans or a child or even more than one, and they'll still want to defend that animal. And I think the teaching here is clear. Man has control in that situation, and man has to act in that situation. Verse 6 then talks about capital punishment. Whoever sheds the blood of man, he's talking here about murder, by man shall his blood be shed. Now, when you think about this verse, you soon realize that God not only is instituting capital punishment, but he's instituting government. He has a law given here, and in that law, that whoever murders, they will be killed, an accounting will be given. As he gives that law, he also says it's by man that this will be done. Now, he's not calling for individual revenge. He's calling for man corporately to establish government, to take care of this matter, this accounting. God demands this accounting, and it has to be done by man, but it isn't one of vengeance. It's the giving of a law and the form by which laws should be carried out. So right here in Genesis 9:6, we have the establishment of law and government, and it's being instituted by God. Now, concerning capital punishment, some say it's an Old Testament concept. God is different now in the New Testament. We're in a different age, an age of grace, and some would argue, well-meaning Christians, some would argue against capital punishment. In Romans 13, we're told, for New Testament believers, to honor, submit to all governments instituted by God. And God is quite clear in chapter 13 of Romans to say there isn't any government that has not been instituted by God. Even vile governments are governments instituted by God. In fact, in the book of Daniel, God says he puts over governments the basis of men. Now, some look at what's commanded of us in Romans 13 concerning submitting to governments and honoring them, and they say, well, that's only if the government does what God wants it to do, only if it's a good, fair, just government. That argument does not hold water. Whenever God says submit, nothing in the text that calls one party to submit to another party implies or guarantees that the party in authority is going to be perfect. And nothing ever says submit unless they're less than perfect, then you don't have to submit. What if they said that to wives? Husbands wouldn't have a chance. Wives, submit to your husbands when they're right, true, and just. And if they make any errors, you don't have to submit. That's not said. What if children only had to obey their parents when in the eyes of the children they thought their parents were right? We are to obey governments, submit to them. Now, Romans 13 was written when the Roman Empire was in full-blown power. And that was an unjust government. That government allowed homosexual behavior, allowed abortion, allowed a lot of cruel and unjust treatment. And yet, in those conditions, God writes in the book of Romans and in Peter's epistle, submit to the government, honor the government, respect them. And some of those statements were said about Nero, who was persecuting Christians at the time. So, government has been instituted by the Lord. It has the right to fulfill what's said here in verse 6, capital punishment, when it's by due process according to the law, is proper and just, and God has instituted it here. It's amazing the foundations that are laid here in the opening chapters of Genesis, and we need to understand them. And when you put them together, like I said, with other New Testament statements and commands, the teachings are clear, and the foundation is provided to keep us following God, even in this post-flood fallen world. Well, now we move on. God establishes a covenant, verses 7 through 11. As for you, God says, be fruitful and increase in number, multiply on the earth and increase upon it. And I have to stop there. I said this earlier and I didn't get to it. There are two commands. Be fruitful is one, increase in number is a second. The two are not identical, and that's important. Being fruitful can refer, obviously, to having offspring and filling the earth, but that's the focus of the second statement, increase in number. Being fruitful has more implications than just, you know, raising families. It speaks of having a life that's productive. God has granted life. You're on this earth. Be fruitful. Be productive. Achieve what the Lord has in store for you. Accomplish the plans. He's given you precious life. He's given you days upon days. Be fruitful with them. And it's an important point. There are some who have been given the gift of singleness, or there are some who are married and are unable to have children, and God states in His Word, children are a gift from God. And for some reasons, again, God has His reasons and purposes, and His ways are not our ways. For some individuals, He doesn't give them the inclination towards marriage, and for others, even though they're married, He hasn't blessed their union with children. They still have a purpose and a plan, and they still are in this command, be fruitful. They may not be in the increase in number part, but they can still be in that be fruitful part. So everybody has been granted life, and everyone is commanded to be fruitful. And then the increase in number, again, is God blessing married couples with children, be that as it may. Verse 8, then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you. And the covenant goes on to include every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, and all the wild animals, all those that came out of the ark with you, every living creature on earth. I establish my covenant with you, and here it is, never again will all life be cut off by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. Now, some would argue that the flood in the Genesis account was a local flood. If so, then God has broken his word. God has broken his covenant, because there have been local floods and they have taken lives. It's very important to understand that a global flood is in view in Genesis, and this covenant only makes sense if there was a total devastation of the earth by flood. Now, the Lord has destruction in store for this present world. Peter writes in his second epistle that this present world is reserved for destruction by God, by fire, though, not by water. Now, it's important that God articulates this covenant for Noah. What if some storm clouds formed? What if a week later, as they were building their houses or something, a terrible thunderstorm started to build? When you're in the middle of such a situation, you don't know if it's global or not. You don't know what you're in for. Noah could all of a sudden panic, and he and his household could head for the old relic of the ark, if you will. This is important so that Noah can rest assured that God is not going to devastate the earth. It's also important for us. The earth isn't going to be destroyed. Those in the 50s were frightened and started building bomb shelters and so forth, and they thought a nuclear holocaust was imminent. Well, God is going to have the elements melt with fervent heat when he decides. And it's not going to be until Revelation chapter 20. When the great white throne appears, then the elements will melt with fervent heat. Earth and sky flee before the presence of the great white throne. But until that time, this covenant is in effect. Now, four groups are mentioned in the covenant. And this came up when we looked at Revelation chapter 4. In Revelation chapter 4, there were four living creatures before the throne of God. They had eyes all over, picturing they were in charge perhaps of surveillance or overseeing things. And these four creatures, I think, coincide with the four groups mentioned in this covenant concerning this post-flood world. The covenant is set up with Noah and his sons, with humans, and includes us, by the way, the descendants. Then it says, secondly, with every living creature. And what's mentioned there has to do with birds, then livestock, and finally wild animals. Humans, birds, livestock, and wild animals are mentioned. Well, those four living creatures in Revelation chapter 4, each had a face. One was like a human. There's the first group mentioned in the covenant. Another was like that of an eagle, could be representative of the birds. Another was like that of an ox, livestock. And the fourth living creature had the appearance of a lion, king of the wild animals. I think these four living creatures mentioned in Revelation 4 have oversight over creation, and they cover four major groups, and it's the four major groups that God here delineates in this covenant of agreement. So we have the Lord's word. By the way, chapter 8 of Genesis also said that there were some other signs of this covenant. As long as there's harvest, springtime, winter, heat, cold, so forth, as long as there's dawning of a new day, God's going to remember his covenant. Well, this covenant gets another sign mentioned, and it's a well-known one, the one of the rainbow, verses 12 to 17. And God said, "This is the sign of the covenant I'm making between you, between me and you, and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come," includes us. Here it is, "I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and you." When Noah saw that first rainbow, I bet it was quite a thrilling moment. The thought is that perhaps there had never been a rainbow before this. Given the water canopy and the makeup of the earth and the climate pre-flood, I happen to agree that there probably wasn't a rainbow. But now, when there's a storm, often the rainbow will be visible, and it's God's reminder to this day of his faithfulness. The word in Hebrew for rainbow is also the word that's used of a warrior's bow. And the picture here is that God isn't going to pull back the string and start shooting arrows onto the earth. Instead, he's placed his bow, much like a warrior putting it up, you know, on the wall. He's not going to be using it. It's hanging there. So that's the picture. "I've set my rainbow in the clouds, and it'll be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth. So God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant I have established between me and all life on earth. Well, with that, the scene shifts to Noah's sons. And there's going to be one episode involving Noah and his sons, and it's going to shape the future of many nations. Verses 18 and 19 declare the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. We're going to see that mentioned again, and it has to do with the episode coming up. These were the three sons of Noah, and from them came the people who were scattered over the earth. In chapter 10, we're going to see the listing of all the different types of people, all the groups, nationalities that came from those three sons. Please understand a most important point. A Christian, given what's written here in Genesis 9 and chapter 10, a Christian probably should not speak of races, different races of men. That is an evolutionary term. Instead, we should understand that just as the animals came on the ark two by two, male and female, just as God in Genesis chapter 1 created each animal, each plant according to its kind, so too there was male and female at the start, Adam and Eve. And they reproduce according to their kind, and that kind is called mankind, or if you will, humankind. And there are not separate and distinct races. The evolutionists that put forth these ideas had also the idea right along with it that some races were more evolved, more advanced than others, and some races weren't worthy. And that was behind the thinking of Hitler and Nazi Germany. It was behind the thinking that just about killed off some tribal people in Australia. It was behind the thinking of the slave trade in Africa. A Christian should understand that we're all one kind. We're all mankind, humankind. What we should then think of when we think of these different groups, we should think of different nationalities. We should think of different ethnic or cultural groups. But they're all from Noah's sons. And that is important for us to understand. And it comes again, that foundational truth comes from what's in chapter 9 and into chapter 10 here of Genesis. But now we see an episode involving Noah and his sons. Starting in verse 20, Noah, a man of the soil, a farmer, did what any farmer did. He planted. He proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of its wine, he became drunk. And then it says, and lay uncovered inside his tent. Now, that word, uncovered, it's the same Hebrew word that's used in many other places in the Old Testament. And often it's used in conjunction with sexual activities, sexual relations. To uncover someone's nakedness was a sort of euphemistic way of speaking of sexual relationships. I say this because as this episode occurs, there are some who say, although it may not be discussed in detail, and God writes in the book of Romans, we should be ashamed to mention some things, some say there are overtones that perhaps there's sexual activity involved in here. Others say, no, what you see is what you get. It's an episode about Noah being naked and a disrespectful viewing of that by his son, nothing more. Well, we'll examine it and I'll speak further about that. But before we get to that, some want to exonerate Noah. Some want to say that Noah, when he got drunk, didn't know what was going on. Some would propose that the fermentation from grapes, the fermentation that made wine, was a post-flood condition that maybe didn't exist pre-flood. I don't buy it. It appears here that Noah has sinned. David was a man after God's own heart, the man God picked to be king, the man God accomplished many great things with, but David also committed adultery with Bathsheba. Many characters in the scriptures show us righteousness, obedience to God, accomplished purposes and plans that God had for them, but also stumble into sin. And I think that's what's being shown here about Noah. Something to note, this is the last we hear of Noah until the last two verses of chapter 9. It says, after the flood, Noah lived 350 years. Altogether, Noah lived 950 years, and then he died. It's a very short, concise, uneventful set of statements about Noah. It's as if Noah accomplished sort of what he was intended to accomplish when he was righteous and obeying God, when he with holy fear built that ark, when he was a preacher of righteousness, as the New Testament declares. He accomplished what God had to accomplish and wanted to accomplish through him. But perhaps here he does stumble, and in essence, that's about it. And nothing else is said of his life, and we know nothing else about it. In some regards, it reminds me of Moses. Raised up by God, accomplished his purposes, but didn't get to enter the promised land. Slipped up at the end, stumbled, disobeyed God, and was sort of then put on the shelf, and that was the end. Be that as it may, we move on. Noah's drunk, and he's laying naked inside his tent. Verse 22 says, Ham, and there again is repeated, the father of Canaan, saw Noah's nakedness, saw his father's nakedness, and told his two brothers outside. But, and notice that contrasting conjunction in verse 23, but Shem and Japheth, they distinguish themselves. They don't behave the way Ham did. Shem and Japheth took a garment, laid it across their shoulders, then they walked in backward and covered their father's nakedness. Now that's an exact contrast to the phrase uncovered their father's nakedness, that uncover one's nakedness, again, is the phrase that speaks of sexual activity. Here they walk in, covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned the other way so they would not see their father's nakedness. The idea is repeated and emphasized in the text. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him. Now that phrase makes some think perhaps that uncovering nakedness has in view some sexual activity. He then, verse 25 tells us, says, cursed be, not Ham, cursed be Canaan. Now, why is he cursing Canaan when Ham did the disrespectful act? This phrase in verse 24, found out what his youngest son had done. When the Old Testament speaks of fathers, sons, descendants, it doesn't always necessarily mean immediate son. It could be that that statement is talking about his youngest grandson. It could be that Ham saw his father's nakedness, started talking about it, went around, told the other sons, maybe told other people. It could be at that point Canaan did something, and that's why the curse comes upon Canaan. Now, I will tell you that this is conjecture. There are many fine scholars that say we don't have to go there. The text says Ham saw his father's nakedness, and when it says he went on then and told his brothers, it appears that he's mocking his father, he's being disrespectful, and that in and of itself would be enough to bring condemnation, judgment upon Ham. Some say this does appear to be the case because Shem and Japheth, in contrast, don't look on their father's nakedness. And it especially goes in great detail to talk about how they walked in backwards so they wouldn't be looking at their father's nakedness. So there may not have been anything done other than when verse 24 says his youngest son had done something, it was to look upon his nakedness and to mock him and spread the news of his nakedness with the other family members. Why then curse Canaan if that's the case? Well, this cursed be Canaan need not be an action that God is going to take. It may be a prophecy. It may simply be a statement of fact. And notice the count twice said Ham was the father of Canaan. If you have a father like Ham who has that sort of attitude in this area, his son is going to grow up to be involved in all sorts of defiling sexual behaviors, and his son, with that kind of, you know, training and example from his father, is going to bring upon himself God's curses and judgment. Now, later, when Moses writes Leviticus, we see a listing in chapter 18 of Leviticus of a bunch of sexual acts that the Israelites were commanded not to be involved in. And many of those acts brought the death penalty. If any woman does this, if any man does this, let them be killed, executed. It's thought that the listing of those specific sexual activities in Leviticus 18 are put there because that is the behavior of the Canaanites. That is the behavior of the people in Canaan, the promised land. And God is going to not let his Israelites be influenced in any way, in any regard, in any of those areas. And that's perhaps the reason for the specific listing, especially involving all those sexual perversions. So it turns out that Canaan was perverse. And that's what characterized the Canaanites in the promised land. Canaan is going to be cursed. And Moses was to lead the people into the promised land, but they didn't obey God and didn't trust him after the report of the spies. So it wasn't until Joshua was leading that the Israelites did cross the Jordan, entered the promised land, and they were told at that time to destroy absolutely, totally the Canaanites there in the promised land. Destroy all the different tribes from the Canaanite family. It was as if they were a cancer, and God wanted to get rid of every single cell. He says, kill them all, kill their animals, kill their livestock, kill the young, the old, everybody. It was as if they were all perverted, and it all could have started right here from this one episode from Ham, the father of Canaan. So that is a clear teaching. It is said that the sins of the father will be visited upon the sons and the generations to come. Not that God does it, but that if a father disregards God's word and behaves in a disobedient, perverse, rebellious style, that's going to influence his children, and that's going to influence the children after them. We see this with patterns of child abuse and incest. It does travel in families. It is a curse that goes on and affects other generations. So I like to understand this statement in verse 25, cursed be Canaan, as a prophecy, as God's way of saying, with this kind of a father, this is what's going to happen. And I think it rings true then with the rest of what's written by Moses. Cursed be Canaan, verse 25 says, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers. When you go to the book of Judges, they are to destroy all the Canaanites. They didn't obey God, and they ended up not driving out all the Canaanites, but with some groups, especially the Gibeonites under Joshua, they were made to be servants to the tribes of Shem and Japheth that entered the promised land, especially Shem. But God goes on with this episode to reward Shem and Japheth for their behavior. He also said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. May Canaan be the slave of Shem. And, verse 27, may God extend the territory of Japheth. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem. And may Canaan be a slave. When we go into chapter 10, just briefly, we'll see that there are different groups coming from these three sons. Japheth, his descendants turn out to be the Indo-European branch. Of which we are part, most of us. We are blessed. We are sort of included in the tents of Shem. Shem turns out to be the Semitic tribes, the Jews and the Arabs, basically, and the Middle Eastern people. Through that lineage comes Jesus Christ. Salvation comes from the Jews. So they are blessed, and they bring salvation to the earth, but we too are under their tents. And the Jews were given the word of God, and we too, you know, are blessed by that. So the Indo-Europeans that come from Japheth, I think in this blessing here, speaks of what our nationalities experienced and continue to experience. Well, then we see those two statements about Noah, and that ends chapter 9. Chapter 10 is the listing of nations, of groups of people, not of races, but of different ethnic groups, nations that came from the sons of Noah. Just in broad terms, the sons of Japheth make up the Indo-European community. The sons of Ham make up the Canaanites and the African groups, and some would also include the Oriental groups under that. It's as if they sort of spread out. Shem resulted in the Jews and Arabs and basically the Middle Eastern people, and they pretty much stayed put. So Japheth sort of spread out and entered into the Indo and European areas, and Ham and his Canaanite descendants were in the Promised Land, but also off to Africa and over perhaps in the Orient, and then Shem being the Jews and Arabs. There's one statement in chapter 10 I want to talk about. Let me also just say that as ancient records come up of groups of people, of cities, of names of nations, the account in Genesis 10 continually rings true. The more archaeologists discover, the more you can see spelling links to what's said here in chapter 10. All of that is to say that what we have in Genesis is fact. Nothing in Genesis is written as if it's mythical. We're not talking with fairy tale explanations of things. We're talking about specific historical facts time after time after time. We've seen it from chapter 1 right on through to this. And again, it always rings true the more archaeologists discover. Well, the verse I want to look at, though, is verse 25 of chapter 10. I know some are disappointed. I'm not going to try to pronounce all the names, but you're just going to have to live with that disappointment. Chapter 25 speaks of two sons being born, and then we're given the name of one of them. Now, with most of the listings, nothing is said, but here something is said about this one named Peleg. The word Peleg in Hebrew means divided, and it said he's named that because in his time the earth was divided. And people say, why is that statement in there? Many think it has reference to what we're about to study quickly in Genesis chapter 11. The Tower of Babel, the changing of the languages, the dispersion of men, dividing men. Others say, though, it could have to do with the post-flood division of the land, of continents. The fissures of the deep were opened for the flood. We now know about tectonic plates and continental drift, and some evolutionists propose that, you know, the drifting has always been the same, just microscopic drifting, a few centimeters every year and so forth. Others say, no, after the flood, the conditions were quite chaotic, and at the time that this child was born, it could be that it was very noticeable, land masses breaking off and the continents starting to spread apart. Imagine what that'd be like when there was, you know, all of a sudden a 10-foot gulf between two major land masses that were joined previous to this. So either or both could be in view here. Interesting concept. Well, with that, we go to the Tower of Babel quickly. Remember God said, go forth, be fruitful, fill the earth? Man's going to disobey that here in chapter 11. Now, the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. And they said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Now notice they're very advanced here. And this tower is going to be what's called a ziggurat, a huge construction. It's going to say reaching to the heavens, but it's going to go up a ways in the sky, and that's going to be it. But it's made with very advanced techniques. Now, why are they doing this? Verse 4 declares, they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that, here's the reason, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. Here on this plain, they were going to build this structure, and it was going to unite all of mankind. They were going to stay right there and accomplish all that they wanted to accomplish. They were in rebellion against God. They were breaking His commandments. They were being prideful. Here is the rise of humanism. And it continues in this earth to this day. Many think man can do whatever he wants. Well, God is not going to stand for rebellion. In the post-flood world, God said the nations were to scatter and fill the earth. That He's not going to let them stay here and accomplish what they want to accomplish. Instead, He's going to make them fulfill His plans. Verse 5 says, but the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that men were building. Now some say, wait a minute, I thought God is in heaven and can see everything. And the answer is, of course He can. Here, as with the judgment upon Sodom and Gomorrah, God condescends to tell us statements that let us know that He is righteous in His judgment. He pictures Himself in human terms. Here He's coming down, He's going to see firsthand, He's going to investigate, and it's all to point out that His judgment is right and just. He's not going by hearsay, evidence, or anything else. Now, of course, God knows the whole situation in heaven, but He puts this kind of terminology in, again, so that we get the proper understanding of His judgment. It is right and just for Him to do it. He's personally investigated, and He's seen the situation. It's said here, and the same thing occurs in the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah. Continuing Genesis, the Lord said, if as one people speak in the same language, they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. The idea is if the Lord lets them accomplish this with their one language being unified and with their prideful mindset, which would only be fueled by this accomplishment, Imagine what plans they would have for themselves. It wouldn't be God's plans. So God says, come, let us, there's a Trinitarian plural, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. And verse 8 simply says, so the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth. Imagine the moment when all of a sudden their language is changed. Everybody would be yelling out something. Two people staying right next to each other wouldn't understand what they're saying, but they might hear somebody 20 feet away yelling something they understood. Well, you know what would happen? They would go over to the person they could understand. So it's a beautiful way to pair off the different groups and accomplish his purposes. Linguistic experts struggling to match evolutionary thoughts to their findings have come up empty. They can't find the evolution of languages. It appears that languages just seem to sprout on the scene all at once and all developed. It's amazing. And it, again, fits perfectly with what is stated here in the book of Genesis. Well, with that, we end our study here in the opening chapters of Genesis with verses 8 and 9 of chapter 11. So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the languages of the whole earth. From there the Lord scattered them all over the face of the whole earth. And with that statement of fact, our study in the opening chapters of Genesis comes to an end. I pray that the crucial truths that we've been looking at have served to strengthen the very foundations of your faith.